promise you, it took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
So we have a goalkeepers team show today, Conor. We've Raymond Galligan coming up, all-star goalkeeper this year for Cavan, and we've Anthony Nash. Obviously was under study for a long time under Donal O'Cusack, made his debut for Cork in 2012, won an all-star that year, and then was shortlisted for player of the year in 2013. So he went from rags to riches very quickly. A very interesting one really with Raymond Galligan is, like most people will know that listen to the show, is, you know, he was a forward up until 2015, when his clubmate Terry Hyland converted him into a goalkeeper, said, look, you're not fast enough to play out the field, we're going to move you into a goalkeeper. Went from making his debut in 2010 for Cavan as a centre forward, taking the frees, scored 10 points that day against Roscommon in the first round, 6 frees in a sideline and 3 from play. And this fella is the next big thing as a forward, Conor. And then 5 years later, finds himself third choice goalkeeper. Like, I mean, and now is an all-star, which really is an incredible story.
Yeah, he really just had to bide his time, didn't he? but he obviously had something. Listen, like, he mightn't have had the pace, but he obviously had the kicking ability. That's why Terry Hyland must have spotted it in him.
Yeah.
But I'd say when he was third choice keeper, he wasn't thanking Terry Hyland for making him go back to goals in the first place.
Well, that was the thing. So, like, I mean, he was third choice goalkeeper. So when Conor Gilson got injured in the league in 2015, it was another goalkeeper, Farrelly fella, came in. So like, it wasn't just, oh, look, you're third choice. He was literally third choice and then got his break before the championship. And that hasn't looked back since then. So I'm looking forward to talking to him, because he's obviously proven my point, Conor, which sometimes people think it's a controversial thing to say, is that any decent outfield player can play in goals. Now, some people don't like hearing that, especially goalkeepers. But Raymond Galligan is living proof that that's a fact.
Well, it's a good job we've two expert goalkeepers here on to talk about it, Willie. And I'm not talking about Raymond Galligan and Anthony Nash. I'm talking about me and you. But
I was goalkeeper for the school 1 year.
Well, far be it from me to stick up. Like, I've never played in goals, Willie, and I never want to play in goals. But I do come from a club with a long line of tradition. Like Kelchamaw for years has provided keepers to the Mayo underage and senior teams. And a lot of my playing career was in front of Peter Burke, which is a real privilege. He's unbelievable keeper for Mayo and Kelchamaw for a long time. So I do have to kind of stand up for them to a certain degree, in that I get you in terms of outfielders. Obviously, they're proficient in catching the ball because everybody has to do it. They have to be decent at kicking the ball. And with before too long, they can become fairly good at kickouts. But I'd say there's still a long way to go in terms of, like, agility, their command of the area in particular, and maybe organising the defence, that you can't just throw any old outfielder in goal.
Listen, every outfield player has to be in command of his area in the air. There is a few little technical things you need to learn, but listen, I'm not going to listen to this. The one thing I always laugh about this is how upset goalkeepers, you know, these lifer goalkeepers, like Cluxton plays outfield, he's like an intermediate level forward, he's not too bad. You know, Fergal Byron, Leash All-Star, he played cornerback at under 21 level when they won in Leinster. You find a lot of goalkeepers, Niall Morgan plays outfield for his club. Like, you find a lot of goalkeepers get very defensive when you say this to them. And then I was thinking the other way around. Like, I played cornerback as minor, I played wing back as minor, I played wing back under 21, wing back at senior, then I played full forward at senior. Now, you don't see Peter Canavan getting, you know, his nose out of joint because I went from corner back up to full forward. Do you know what I mean? Goalkeepers are a little bit oversensitive to this.
Yeah, a little bit. I just know, Willie, that, like, you say you played in goals before. I never did. Anytime I stand, you know, the odd time you might stand in goals in training, and it was so easy to beat me. And, you know, just didn't have a clue in terms of positioning, in terms of agility. That might be just me, my kind of personal ability as an all-rounder. But anytime I did it, I had more respect for goalkeepers afterwards, because I kind of appreciated what they had to do a little more. And maybe, as I said, that's because I was used to playing in front of really good goalkeepers, because, you know, we always had them at my club. But listen, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one, given how strongly you obviously feel on the matter.
Kavanagh actually had to recruit Republic of Ireland goalkeeper Gary Rogers as a goalkeeping coach to help Raymond along. So he obviously deserved credit. I'm joking, obviously. I'm trying to wind up goalkeepers, but there are loads of technical stuff that you obviously have to learn as a goalkeeper. My point is that you can learn them, you know, like any position, you know. I think that's fair. Anthony Nash then will be coming up in part two. He obviously responsible for the Nash rule. I've had Anthony on the show before and never spoke to him about the Nash rule. Anthony made his debut in 2012. He got a penalty against Wexford, which he scored. Anthony, the only way I can describe Anthony Nash's penalty technique is, I hope this isn't disrespectful, do you know the way a volleyball player throws the ball way up ahead of themselves and does this big kind of smash serve? That's the way he did the penalty. So he'd take the penalty from the 21, and by the time he'd hit it, he would be in on the 13. Yeah. And he got away with this all through 2012 until the final. He got a penalty in the final and Patrick Kelly rushed out to save it. So while the ball was hanging in the air and Nash was ready to whack it, Patrick Kelly was running out to meet that. And Stephen O'Keefe then did it in 2014 where he got it. I think he got it in the backside. And the GA says, we have to do something about this. This is a player welfare issue. Nash is going to take the head off somebody at some stage. And the Nash rule, it was called. And now penalties are taken. You can't come inside the 21. And it's changed actually since then, where it's turned into a one-on-one penalty. So, you know, he's had a huge impact on GAA in his career.
Yeah, and to be fair, like, I think that rule was fair. As much as I loved, there was a real sense of excitement any time Anthony Ash got a penalty.
Ah, there was, yeah.
Because you knew what he was going to do, especially, and that year particularly, 2013, was very exciting as well, just with the emergence of Clare and stuff like that, Stephen O'Donnell in the final. But something did have to be done, to be fair. Like, Patrick Kelly, fair play to him. Stephen O'Keefe was you have to have a fatalistic streak, I think, if you're running out, if you're sprinting towards a guy who's probably the hardest hitter of the ball in hurling. And not only that, he's hitting it from a closer distance than you're meant to from an actual penalty. But all you have to do if you want to justify the introduction of that rule is to go back and look at Stephen O'Keefe's leg after he blocked that shot. It was, yeah. I've never seen a bruise like it. It was unbelievable.
But having said that now, and Anthony Nash has made this point, and I'm going to put it to him, and he makes a point, what if a fella catches a ball just outside the 6-yard box and he catches it clean and I'm standing on the goals? Should I tap him on the shoulder and go, here, go out to the 20 metre line because it's a bit dangerous if you hit it from there? Do you know what I mean? That was Anthony's argument at the time.
Yeah, but this is where that's different, and that's not a set piece. You know, would that not be a kind of an argument against that? I don't listen, Willie. The day I start wading into hurling arguments is a dangerous one for me and everybody, I think. So, yeah. But that would be my point, maybe, that it's because it's not a set piece, and you're in an you're in a position as a rule maker to influence the penalty, whereas you mightn't be. I don't know. Do you create another rule for situations like Anthony's imagined there? But it seems an easier fix for the penalty than.
Yeah, I know. Well, the other scenario is absurd that you would even think of telling a fella to go back out, you know. But anyways, that was his take. I'll ask him about it in part two. John Fogarty had a piece in The Examiner where he says water breaks could be here to stay. So he says there have been discussions about the water break becoming a permanent feature in preserving the playing surface for those directly involved. Now, let's break that sentence down. So John would obviously have good contacts in Croke Park, and he's saying that there's been discussions about the water break becoming a permanent feature, right? So this year, fair enough, it'll probably be a permanent feature. This COVID thing hasn't gone away yet. That's grand. You'd imagine surely that's the end of it then after this year. But listen to the second part of the sentence. Could become a permanent feature in preserving the playing surface for those directly involved. Like, if they're going to keep this water break so that they don't want to, because obviously the Mayor Ferna and the, you know, they've been banned and water carriers are not allowed in the field. Is this to preserve the playing surface for the players? And the reason I find this hilarious is because I was a sideline reporter for News Talk for years. And I used to get in terrible trouble in Croke Park because I'd come out, I'd be on the Hogan stand side and the dressing rooms were on the Cusick stand side. So when the game would be over, the players would be walking away from me, you know, towards the Cusick stand. So I wasn't allowed on the pitch. So I used to just, you know, leg it across the pitch. So I'd be there waiting as the players are passing me and try to get a post-match interview. And then Croke Park demanded that I can't walk across the pitch. Now, I'm in a pair of bloody Converse runners, like I'm like a pair of slippers. It's not like I'm walking out onto a white carpet with dirty shoes or mucky shoes that, like, your mother would give you a little clip for. So what they wanted me to do was to walk the whole way down around by the canal end and back up. And sure, by the time I did that, then I'd have lost the fellas probably, you know, a lot of them are the ones I wanted going in off the pitch. So it might sound absurd to people listening here now that they would be even considering keeping the water break to keep anyone other than players on the pitch. But I firsthand experienced that this could easily be the case.
Did Croke Park not think about, Wooly, the potential for you to provoke the crowds or whatever, Steph? You were walking past the canal end and somebody walking past, and somebody saw you walking past and might start giving you a bit of guff. But I'm interpreting this wrong, Wooly. I thought that the water break was to become a permanent feature, so you don't have water carriers and you don't have them, you don't have them interfering with the play during the play. So the players aren't allowed to have a drink during normal play and they have to wait for the water break. Because the playing surface rule seems a bit ridiculous. You know, if it's particularly for the playing surface alone, that seems a bit ridiculous to me. So unless I've got the wrong end of the stick here, I don't know. If it's for that reason alone, it seems ridiculous. I don't agree with the water breaks anyway, but I can nearly see a point if they want to, prevent people from running on the pitch during the play.
Yeah, no, it's more to, I would accept it if it's interrupting play or it doesn't look great because there's been occasions where Mir Furnas have got involved in the play, and it doesn't look great. But I would hope water breaks are gone after this year. I don't think, I hate breaking the game down into quarters. I hate it. And, I don't think it has much support. We'll ask Raymond and Anthony because, even in that piece, Liam Cahill and Paul Murphy were asked about it. And nearly all players are saying the same thing. If you're leading, you don't want the water break. But alternatively, you could be losing and the water break is a lovely little break in play. There's no defence of it or there's no critique of it because you could be in either situation. So just get rid of it.
Yeah, well, this might sound like a ridiculously simple. You've kind of hinted at it already, Wooly. But if you leave water breaks a permanent feature, you're changing a game that's been two halves, as long as it's existed, into four quarters. And I know that sounds simplistic, but it has a huge impact. And we saw that, to be honest, I actually didn't think it impacted on county games, inter-county games, as much as it did a club. Any club game you watched on TV last year, do you remember when the club games were on TV there before the inter-county championship started? The water break had a massive impact on every single game. And I know that every club game I played last year, it had a huge impact. I mean, completely changed the flow of the game. It just... You can't speak about it beforehand. You're like, we'll have a water break, so we have to be able to, not let that momentum shift happen. And it always happened. And I don't know, did that say more about the better concentration levels of intercounty players than club players that it didn't? I don't think it impacted as much. But it would be a completely fundamental shift in the game. Yeah. I'd be against it. I mean, you're talking about a minute, if it is to prevent people from coming on the pitch, I think there's ways of doing it that prevents the game from being divided into four quarters. I think that the ability of it to affect momentum, I think, is too much. And I don't know, I'd be in favour of any alternative, basically, that would prevent the water break becoming a permanent feature. So you're dividing the game into four as it is, as opposed to two, which it already is and has been for as long as we know.
Yeah, well, that's it. I'm sure that would have to be a motion be brought to Congress to allow that to become a permanent thing. You couldn't imagine it would get too much support. Malachy Clerkin had a great piece in the Irish Times this week, and he's talking about a case will come before the High Court in Belfast on behalf of an 8-year-old footballer from Maharafelt, County Derry. His parents are challenging the COVID restrictions laid down by the Northern Ireland Department of Health that effectively prohibit children playing organised team sport during the pandemic. It's a mother presenting evidence of an 8-year-old boy showing physical and behavioural deterioration and arguing that the banning of youth sport for 9 of the past 12 months is the major contributing factor. We've mentioned this before, Conor, on the show about how children cannot, who are very, very low risk, and being outside in the fresh air, especially in winter time when it's windy and etc., it's so low risk. Drop them off, collect them again. And the benefits that they will get from playing sport with their friends and meeting their friends by far outweighs the risks that are associated to anybody else. And it's just a head scratcher how the hell this is continuing, because we've come out of the worst of it now in January and February. Like, at the end of the day, it's so low risk, outdoor sports. Children are such low risk. They're allowed back to school. It just cannot believe it. So there's solicitor Stephen Atherton. He said, and for me, he's speaking a lot of sense. He says, we accept that the state is entitled to infringe on the human rights of the population on public health grounds. That is absolutely true. But legally, you have to do a cost benefit analysis. What is the benefit of the this restriction? We're saying that the benefit to public health of preventing kids playing sport cannot be demonstrated. They say there are concerns over mobility and the movement of people, but that's not evidence. In fact, the scientific evidence shows how minimal the dangers of transmitting between children are. We also argue that not only can they not demonstrate any benefit to public health, they haven't undertaken an appropriate consideration of the harms that these measures are causing to children. Now, is that not well put? At what point is a cost kind of analysis going to be done and say, right, here's a benefit. How much benefit is there of banning sport? Not a huge amount because it's so low risk. And, you know, what are the damages that it's causing to the people that we're prohibiting from playing the sport?
Yeah, that's a very important point to make, William, that like we can see, listen, nobody's, we've said this often enough, it doesn't need to be repeated as well, but nobody is saying that the situation isn't very, very serious and the impact of COVID has had such an impact on loads and loads of people. But we can see the tangible impact in terms of the figures that we see all the time. Do you know what I mean? In terms of the number of cases, the number of people that have sadly passed away, whatever. Whereas it's hard to produce that tangible evidence for the other side of it. Do you know, as in it's hard to, you don't have numbers to, you don't have as clear numbers, let's say, to demonstrate the amount of people that have been affected by not being able to participate in sport, the impact that that's had on people's mental health and stuff like that. And when I first saw this, the important thing to mention, Stephen Atherton makes his case very well. The piece that Malky Kirkman wrote is very good, very sensible. And it's just like, it's not frivolous at all. As in, like, that's the point that Malky makes, is that like there's a judicial system in Northern Ireland that prevents, if this was a frivolous case that these parents are making, it would be got rid of from the get-go. But yeah, the Department of Health in Northern Ireland consider that there's a reasonable case to be made here. Do you know what I mean? And just in terms of what you said there about getting the kids back, for me, it was a no-brainer. Like, as soon as the schools are back in an indoor setting, it seemed to me a no-brainer to get them together in an outdoor setting. And you just have to, the risk of transmission, if you said there, isn't them being outdoors. It's maybe it's the transporting to and from training. But you have to trust the people involved in these sports to be able to look after that. As they did such a good job last summer, and they're going to do such a good job if you trust them to do it again, which hopefully people will see and do it from next month onwards.
So Malachy had it in that piece. And again, we're specifying that this is children we're talking about, not even arguing for. I would be in favour of all teams being allowed to train outdoors. But we're only talking here in this example for children, for bloody children, because they're such low risk. And Malachy had in the piece, it was reported in the Sunday Times that in 12 months of detailed tracing of positive COVID tests in professional soccer, American football, rugby league and rugby union, there hasn't been a single case of on-field transmission. Now, like, I mean, that's just incredible. So, like, I can see a lot of problems coming down the road if court cases like this are going to be brought for the government not allowing people train and exercise outside. I can see they're, you know, open up a big can of worms. And again, you know, does the damages outweigh the benefits? You know, that's the question you have to ask. Paddy Christie actually has a great piece with Niall McIntyre on Sports Show, and he said, and Paddy's been very fair in the piece again. And again, because it's such a sensitive subject, you have to qualify everything that you say and be sensitive to the people, lost loved ones and lost relations and people who have been very sick. There are other people then who've had it, like people I know who didn't even know that they had it. So, you know, it's a very strange, you know, respiratory virus. But Paddy Christie was saying on Sports Show, I don't want anything to happen to my mother and father. And needless to say, you're careful about things. On the other hand, personally speaking, I don't think I'm prepared to throw my two kids under the bus to save my parents. That's a very crude way of looking at things. I'd like to see them both looked after, but at the moment, we'd seem to be heavily sided on looking after the elderly and certain groups in society. I don't think anyone's arguing, like I see what Paddy's saying there, I don't think anyone is arguing to say that, you know, you don't want to throw your children under the bus to save your parents. You would like to think a balance can be struck where your parents can be protected and your children can exercise and meet friends and, you know, in a safe manner. I think that we probably leave it on that point, Connor.
Yeah, well, just to say that, like, Paddy Christie spoke, as he seems to speak on every subject, he spoke a lot of sense on this particular topic. And the one thing that stood out to me was he was talking about his own children and just said that they'd become kind of withdrawn and kind of shadows of themselves.
Yeah.
You know, over the last few months, even the last year, because they're not being exposed to the, I suppose, the type of outdoor activity that they're used to, like training with their friends and stuff like that. And I think we mentioned this already, but like, you know, I can give it to, if I'm told I can't play football for, you know, 6 months, a year, I can live with that. You know, I don't like it, but I can live with it. But a year for a child, it has potential to make a big impact, you know, long term, and that they start to become accustomed to it, and it'll take a long time for them to kind of overcome it. So as we said here, like, it's not the case for adults we're making, it's for children. And I think especially, yeah, as I said, after they've gone back to school, I think the next step is inevitably and should be that they're allowed back playing sport again.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I have a neighbour and her daughter's, I think she's in around the 11, 12 kind of bracket, but her birthday is in April. So she missed her birthday last year and now she's going to miss her birthday again this year. Like, that's two birthdays at the age of 12. Like, it's, yeah, you know, 1/6 of your birthdays at that age when they're so important to you and you're missing both of them. I just think that kind of stuff is cruel on children at this stage. Ronan McCarthy, right, so I think Ronan McCarthy needs to cop on. I don't want to talk about this too much because we obviously know what he did was wrong. He was training outside. He was in breach of GAA, no training training rules, and he was also in breach of government COVID rules. That's not why he got the ban. He got the ban because of the GAA rule, but he appealed it. Paddy Talley appealed and got it down to eight weeks. Ronan McCarthy appealed and he lost his appeal to the hearings committee. And then he went to the next one, which was the appeals committee, and he's failed in that one as well. So now he's going to wait and see to bring it to the DRA, because that's obviously the three stages for your appeals. And I don't know what he's playing at. So his ban started on the February 18th. He can't have any involvement with the squad until the middle of May. Now, how big, most of his, who is going to be monitoring Zoom calls, talking to his panel, yeah, for one? So he can just forget about that up until the start of April. So his ban really is only a month. He'll probably start training the 5th of April up until the middle of May. He's looking at maybe a 5-6 week ban. And let's be honest, change your training session somewhere in Cork and take the bloody session. Give me a break, Ronan. Will you just let that go? That's my take on that.
I'm pretty much the same, Willie. I mean, we spoke about the ban for Paddy Daly and Ronan McCarthy a few weeks ago, and I didn't have much sympathy for either, particularly considering the stance that the GAA had taken on collective training before Christmas, and probably more pertinently, but the situation that the country was in on the 2nd of January when the Cork team were caught on the beach in public. I mean, some felt the ban was a bit harsh. I didn't think it was too bad, because I think you have to crack down on these things eventually. So, and then, as you said, by the time everyone's back training, his ban will effectively be 5 to 6 weeks. And I think at this stage, like, there are ways and means around if he wants to be involved, you know what I mean? Especially in the planning and all these Zoom calls and stuff like that, he's going to be involved. Nobody's going to be monitoring that. There's probably ways and means for him to be involved in the eventual training sessions. But at this stage, you know, he's exhausted every avenue. Anyway, just like
He can still go to the DRA. I don't think it's a good look for him. I think he should let it go. But anyways, Connor, so he captained Cavan to an Ulster title in November, followed it up with an All-Star after some great performances in the Championship. Not bad for a man who only started playing in goals in 2015. It's Raymond Galligan, and he joins us on the line now. How's it going, Raymond?
Not too bad, Colin. Thanks very much for having me.
No bother. Come here, is it fair to say that you were a jack of all trades and now you're a master of one?
Well, I still make that. That's still questionable now, to be honest. But I've definitely seen a few different positions with Calvin, that's for sure.
Well, like, I mean, let's be honest. You moved into goalkeeping in 2015. You've now got an All-Star, which is the highest accolade you can get in a specific position. You beat Stephen Cluxton to an All-Star, and I think he's undoubtedly the best goalkeeper we've ever seen. So, like, I mean, it's not bad going. I know you're going to be modest.
I had a great couple of months there. I was very lucky, you know, the performances kind of went my way, and, you know, the finish up with an All-Star at the end of the year, it was lovely, like, for myself and for my family and club. But Yeah, like it was definitely a roller coaster, a couple of years trying to learn the trade of goalkeeping, and to find myself then this year picking up the All-Star, it really was dicing on the cake, I suppose.
So let's get into this transformation, because I'm very interested in this. I've made some comments on the show here, Raymond, and look, they haven't always gone down well with goalkeepers, but I've always said that a good outfield player can easily turn into a goalkeeper, especially with you. Tell us about where you started off. Like, you were the marquee forward at underage level, and you made your debut with the Cavan Seniors in the league and scored 10 points. You were the free taker, you were the full forward.
Yeah, so like that, yeah. So all my underage, I probably played outfield, minor and under 21, played like 40 midfield kind of area. And then when I moved in on the senior panel, then like back in 2006, number of years, I was kind of in and out in the league and that, getting in full forward, centre forward, playing league games, McKenna Cup. Couldn't really nail down championship start till like 12. And then, yeah, I think that my full forward days were just kind of running out, and Terry Hyland basically gave me an ultimatum. He said, like, I'd try a third-choice goalkeeper, and you can train for a couple of months, and you get an opportunity with a challenge game between the league and championship in 15. And he said, that's really all I can guarantee you, because there's a line of full forwards at the time. We had Gibney and Keating, Niall McDermott. Yeah. There's a whole, some great lads. So I kind of knew myself, like, I wasn't going to make it in around that area. So I said, I'd try this out, and I suppose I ended up, we played New York in a challenge match over in New York, and yeah, that went well, and I ended up making it against Monaghan in the championship that year.
Right, and you haven't looked back since. So, like, I mean, how psychologically could you change, you know, from being a scoring forward, which you still were with your club the whole way along, I'm fairly sure you still are, and to change to being standing there with not a whole lot to do for a lot of a game?
Yeah, I suppose it's just like, it just kind of comes back to, do you really want to play, you know, because like obviously in 15 and 16, like, you're nearly the butt of a lot of jokes, kind of going back to the club and your third child goalkeeper and the words out, you're kind of like, things are going too well in training, and you can't really dive. And so it kind of just worked so hard, I suppose, in 15 behind the scenes. Like, Gary Rogers was our goalkeeping coach, and I used to get a couple extra sessions with the likes of Shane Supple. Like, I was living in Dublin, so I was literally trying to train as much as possible on the quiet behind the scenes to improve my goalkeeping. And I suppose when I got my chance then, I suppose I'd put in that much work and watched the lads. I just like gave it everything, and just very lucky it went my way when I got my chance. And yeah, like, it's anybody can do it if they put their mind to it. Like, it's the shot stopping was the big problem for me, because I suppose I had the luxury of being able to kick off the ground. So yeah, that was the big bit of work, and you know, that's, you're ever trying to improve that, I suppose, and the shot stopping.
Well, Terry Hyland made an interesting comment. I was reading an article, and he says, if your team is set up properly with a good defence, there shouldn't be any more than 3 shots on a goalkeeper in a game, 3 max. Between points and wides, you're looking at an average of 25 to 30 restarts in a game. And that's the most important part of a goalkeeper's role. So the way he looked at it, and we know Terry Hyland would have been one of the more, you know, defensive managers, he would have saw your ability to kick out and your ability to play a bit of football as being more important maybe than the shot stopping at that time, or maybe the fielding and stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, that was it. Back then, I suppose we were, Joe Brody put a lovely name on us back about being the Black Death in 14 and that. And I suppose we were somewhat defensive in that time. But like that, it suited our team. And, you know, we had a great time in 2016 getting promoted, and we had a good run in the championship. So it suited the way we were playing. But like that, yeah, we didn't have a lot of goal opportunities as we would now, because I suppose we play a much more attacking game, and you know, we do leave ourselves obviously at times open, but I suppose that's what you get when you kind of go more attacking. So it probably now more than ever there's more shots on goal, but I suppose that kind of suits us now, to be honest. So yeah. It's constantly changing.
You mentioned that you were the third choice goalkeeper. Like, so Conor Gilsonen was the first choice goalkeeper in 2015, and he was injured in the final league game against Meath, I think it was, and James Farrelly came in instead of him. So there was no doubt the whole way through that league that you were third in the pecking order after you used to be a forward. Like, I mean, were you thinking of packing it in at that stage?
I suppose I was kind of just clutching on to Terry. Like, to be fair, he was so straight. Like, he's a great man. Like that, you know, he was honest from day one and just told me, like, you know, it's a very, very slim chance that you get playing. But he did guarantee me a challenge match, and I suppose it was just kind of holding out. And then I was starting to enjoy it as the league was going on. Like, I didn't really travel many games with them in the league because, like that, they were just kind of bringing the lads that were talking out. And right. So yeah, so you're just constantly training and going to games and kind of waiting your chance. But yeah, like that, I was starting to enjoy it, and fair to players were very, like, you know, giving me a bit of praise that you were sticking at it. And it was just kind of, when I got my chance then, I was just lucky I took it. And yeah, it was definitely a crazy year that in 15, that's for sure.
Yeah, because he's your club mate, right, Terry Highland?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So he kind of...
You'd obviously never played in goals for your club. It's not like he had this insider knowledge that you could, you know, that he'd seen you, you know, playing in a game or two with the club.
No, that's it. Like, yeah, I actually, I don't think I've actually ever played a full game at my club in goals to date. so it's, yeah, but I think Terry kind of figured that my gears weren't really up to scratch for out the field, that he kind of thought this might be a wiser move for me long term.
Did he ring you after you won the All-Star?
Ah, he did, yeah. I know, he's like, I think you know very well at Terry. Like, he's a great man, and like that, he's been very good to a lot of the players since he moved on from Cavan. So, absolutely, yeah.
Right, was he bragging, or was it a congratulations?
I know, he was just looking at congratulating me, all right, yeah. But I'm sure he knows he had a part to play in it, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, he definitely did. It was some call, there's no doubt. So you mentioned Gary Rogers and you mentioned Shane Supple. So, like, I mean, this is, again, back to my theory that outfield players are good at fetching. You know, they're good with the ball in their hand. You, especially being a free taker, your kickouts were sorted. What were the challenges then in the shot stopping, and what were they able to teach you?
Yeah, I suppose just more... position and feet work, just being able to kind of like move your feet that bit quicker, getting across the goal, spreading yourself, and just being more of a presence around the goal, communicating as well with the backs and kind of right. Just kind of getting. So like it sounds fairly straightforward, but I suppose it's just like that. Yeah, the shot stopping, it is a big, like that really is your job when you're there to stop the goals and take the kick out. So. Like that, you're constantly trying to work on it over the years, and I'm sure every keeper is. So, but yeah, I suppose you have to really want it as well, because it's not a luxury position really now either. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted to kind of keep playing for Cavan, and I just got the opportunity, I suppose. Took it.
I mentioned this to Rory Began before. I think it was Neville Southall was talking about David De Gea, the Manchester United goalkeeper, and he's brilliant at saving with his feet. And Neville Southall said that technically that's not what a goalkeeper is supposed to do, that you're supposed to move your feet, get your footwork in a position that you can save it with your hand.
Yeah, but that's it. Like, I suppose it's... the fact that I had no real traits built up because I hadn't really been there before, getting the likes of Gary Rogers starting off with me was great, because like he kind of showed me the best techniques to try and spread yourself and you know, get yourself across the goal as quick as possible. So I was really starting off with a blank canvas, and you know, like that, there's lots of goals by me in 15 and 16. I think Tyrone copped it fairly quick in 16 by me one day. Like that, yeah, you're trying to just constantly tweak it and get better, and you know, trying to make them save as much as possible. So yeah
So like, when the rest of the team are away and they're doing their training, any team I've ever been on, the goalkeepers are away doing their own kind of stuff, you know, and taking shots on each other, throwing the ball to the ground and all the warm-up drills. Like, do you enjoy that now? Have you completely changed your mindset to, you know, this is the stuff I really enjoy, rather, or would you be looking up the other end going, geez, wouldn't it have been great if if I was up there?
Yeah, no, I do really enjoy it, because, well, I suppose we do engage in a lot of the trainings now, you know, like so much more football been played and you're, you know, being part of the games, albeit you're in the goals, but no, like that, you're constantly trying to improve, and like kickouts are so important as well, that you're amongst the team a lot more than you would have been maybe years previous, where it was a case maybe of, you know, get it out as far as you can, and there wasn't a big emphasis on kickouts. So yeah, no, it's there's a nice mix of working with the keepers, but also you're mixing with the players a lot there during the trainings now these days.
When you get back, you better clarify that one, definitely. Come here. And like, I mean, this year it was noticeable for me, well, for Roscommon definitely, and for yourself, that you went long with your kickouts a lot more this year. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, like, I suppose we had the Thomas and the Groge and James Smith. There was numerous kind of men with a big presence that like they were option for long kickouts. And, you know, teams are really pressing up more now, so they are maybe where previous to what allowed you a short kick out. So that option, you have to have that option now, I think, to go long, because teams are pressing up throughout the country.
That's the thing. And like, I mean, from a goalkeeper's point of view, I'm sure when there's a big press on you, sometimes I'd be pulling my hair out. There's a big press on a goalkeeper. He looks one way, he looks the other way. Now there's a bit of tension goes right throughout the team because there's nothing on. And then he ends up going long. Instead of just going, right, there's a huge press on here, I'm going to act like this is no big deal to me and just go to one of my long targets.
Yeah. Definitely. I think it's a lot about just, you know, making it as simplistic as you can when teams do that, because like that, there's no point in taking major risk when you know you have a big presence in the foot forward line. Like if you're looking out, like take Donegal, for example, where they have such, you know, a good foot forward line, and maybe conditions aren't great, like it's not worth taking the risk of going short and putting the whole team under pressure. Like if it means putting it 70 yards into a position where you have maybe extra bodies, like worst case scenario, you lose it and it's still 70, 80 metres away from goal. Yeah. You know, so.
Well, that's the thing. And is that something Mickey Graham kind of would have instructed you, or would you discuss this as a panel, or would the corner back say, geez, in those instances, you know, it's not ideal for me to be, you know, taking that ball? Because I often think that Dublin are so good at doing that, just because they're able to do it doesn't mean that it's, you know, comfortable for every team.
Yeah, like, you know, like definitely stuff we work on in regards, like, having outlets and opportunities for maybe a mismatch. But I suppose that it's probably the same with every team now is doing. They're kind of looking at the opposition and seeing where maybe we could find space, or who maybe be a good man to give a long kick out if we need, or to go short. But I suppose a lot of it depends on like the grounds. You know, when you're playing in the likes of Breffni and Clonus, you've got the luxury of space, and it's a lot easier to put the ball into them pockets, where maybe in the likes of Armagh, I've always found it very tight. Just a little bit narrower and things like that.
Yeah.
Crow Park, again, it's completely different as well with the surface and everything. So it does have an impact, like on kickouts with the size of the ground as well.
Yeah. How did you find the aftermath of the Ulster final win? Like, I mean, your captain, I don't think you actually made a speech, or did a speech not get shown on television?
Yeah, no, we just kind of we decided before on the Friday night of training that like we weren't going to make a speech. I know that sounds a bit arrogant, like we're thinking what we were thinking if we get over the line, the plan will be that we'd hold out until we had the entire team there. So when we got back to Breffni to do a speech, because
right.
Like not only the 26 could be there, so we said we'd hold out until everybody was there and back in cabin in Breffni. So
right. And did you make the speech then back in Breffni when you had you basically lifted the trophy again, didn't you?
Yeah. So the entire panel came in and met us in Breffni Park, and it was just all the players and just their family, their mother and fathers and brothers and sisters just all came in. So it was just all very low key, but it just kind of gave the entire panel the opportunity to kind of witness us actually lifting the cup, and give everybody an opportunity to kind of play, feel the cup up close, really. So
yeah, no, that was it was a brilliant call. Like, I mean, there's no doubt that was a lovely touch, and considering you were such underdogs, it was a really good call, you know, to make beforehand. I'm sure you were very confident.
Yeah, like that, sure. I suppose it was the way and the manner we kind of got to the Ulster final, that we kind of came back from 10 points with down and 7 against Monaghan. We were just slowly kind of building something special, and you know, we just felt if we kind of put a 70 minute performance against Donegal that we'd be thereabouts. And I suppose on the day everybody kind of done their job and we got over the line, thankfully.
Yeah, what I'd say the moment of the championship was the free against Monaghan at the end, and how you weren't, like, you could have been 15 points down at half time in that game, talking about riding your luck. And then, like, I mean, it was just incredible, the kick out, the catch, the free, and like, I mean, Jesus, it was a long way out, Raymond.
It was a bit mad. Now, definitely watched it back a few times over Christmas, like, and it was all a bit mad the way it just kind of worked out. And I suppose it was like more special, the fact that like, it was Thomas, like my cousin, that won the kick out and set me up for the free. But the lads really showed some great determination to kind of just keep chipping away at Monaghan and like force the extra time. Sure, look, I suppose I was fortunate that got the accolades or the reward for kicking the free, but like the lads put in some monster scores in the lead up to that, definitely from the likes of Jerry Smith, Chris Connery, Groge, like there's some fantastic scores in that game as well.
Yeah, no, they're definitely. Isn't it mad that your cousins, like your two Galligans, and you played such a big part in his All Star, and he played such a big part in yours?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I called up them there at Christmas, and there was like these three crystal balls sitting on top of the mantelpiece, and I said, "What are they for?" And he said, "Also fine, I think the Monaghan game." And I said, "That's it. I'm going short next year." No, it was a great year now, that's for sure.
Well, that's the thing, like, I mean, Kavanagh only had two All-Stars, like, in the 50 years of All-Stars until this year, and then you go and get three. So, like, I mean, it must be a huge honour, because I talked to Conor Sweeney last year, and there's only three ever in Tipperary, and he's one of the three. You know, like, there's only five ever in Cavan. It's a short list that you will always be, you know, that you were on.
Yeah, no, like, I suppose it hasn't really sunk in. Like, it is, I think for my family, especially, like, they feel very proud, and like for my club, especially having two in the one club, like it is lovely and it's a bit surreal. Like, I suppose it's just unfortunate that we can't kind of get back training to kind of have the banter and the bit of slagging and that to kind of really let it sink in and, you know, be able to kind of mix with the lads. So I suppose it's, you know, where you'd be able to even go down to the club training and maybe mix with the underage and kind of have that little bit of fun with them. You can't get that now. And, so I suppose on that side of things, it's just a little bit, it's a lot more quieter. And but it is lovely now, I suppose, to be honest.
Yeah. Before I let you go there, there's talk that the water breaks are could be here to stay. They're definitely going to be in this year. And there's talk in Croke Park that potentially they might keep them on. What's your thoughts on that? We were talking about it at the start of the show.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of a mixed enough. Like, it all depends on how you're going. Like, it's, yeah. If you're on top and you have the momentum, like, the last thing you want is a break. But I suppose, like, that we've had lots of games last year that, you know, we really needed that kind of minute or two to kind of reset and just, you know, change tack. And so I suppose, like, it can go with you some days, and some days you really don't want it. I would sit in the fence now with that one, to be honest.
I think most people are given the exact same reason as that, and is that they're breaking momentum, and sometimes that's awful for you, sometimes that's good for you. So, like, I mean, maybe that just works 50-50. Do you think they're a good idea, like, as in needing to rehydrate? You know, is that part of it needed?
I don't think so. But if you're a goalie, it's not too bad. You have the water there.
You supply the full forward line and the full back line with water.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. I don't really think there's need for them. Like, lads are training away on their own now. So I think, you know, they're going to be going back in pretty good condition. So don't really think there is major need for them, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly right, Raymond. I've kept you long enough. I know you have to get back to work. Thanks very much for taking the call.
Not at all. Thanks very much, Willie.
Yeah, great stuff from Raymond there. There's some bad news in Tyrone during the week, Conor. Fergal McCann, he died on Monday night after a long illness. I think it was cancer. He was only 47. Absolutely heartbreaking stuff. And he trained Tyrone to All-Irelands in 2005 and 2008. And I don't know about you, but I hadn't heard much about Fergal McCann. He's one of these trainers who just likes to stay in the background, massively highly rated, you know, and they're in every county. There's some other trainers then who, you know, like to have a higher profile, you know, and that's fine as well. But the tributes to him, you know, were kind of noticeable. Owen Mulligan said, "Never underestimate what this man did for Tyrone football. You can talk about the players and the managers we had in 2005 and 2008, but Fergal was a genius on the training field." You know, giving him huge credit for 05 and 08. Mickey Hart says, "So we went over to Tony Donnelly's house. Tony Donnelly had recommended Fergal," he says, "one night, and met him, and Fergal produced a file of training sessions he'd done with Ocher. He was so meticulous. He planned everything so well. He was very, very efficient. When we wanted to take a look at certain aspects of our game, we'd be working out drills, he'd be working out drills immediately, drawing diagrams and pulling things together. He brought a great energy to it." And probably the best tribute I saw was Philip Jordan, which He said, what set Fergal apart was the ability to make training drills relevant to match situations. Training drills are easy, but the ability to help players apply them in a match is what defines a great coach. Without Fergal, I would only have one All-Ireland. Thanks for everything you allowed me to achieve. On top of his ability as a coach, Fergal is one of the good guys in life. Isn't that an incredible tribute by Philip Jordan, really, there? Without Fergal, I would only have one All-Ireland.
Yeah, it was really nice. And no more than yourself, Willie, I hadn't heard much about Fergal, and that probably speaks to his character. And like, I always find, without wanting to tar everyone with the same brush, but that like these unsung heroes, they often have more kind of affection with the players than maybe somebody who might want to stand out a little more. And that probably showed in the tributes from Philip Jordan and Owen Mulligan and Mickey Hart. But like, as I said, I hadn't heard much about him. But like, what I would say is that apart from this Dublin team, for example, that 2005 to 2008 Tyrone team was probably the best I've seen. Maybe like the Kerry team of a similar era would be up there as well. But what Philip Jordan said there is really important too, about, you know, we spoke last week about like Kevin Welch and philosophies and all this sort of stuff. But I think that like the ability to adapt to what a team needs is so important as well. Like, you know, you might set out to play one way, but then you realize that your players are better set to maybe go in a different direction. And it sounds like from what Mickey Hart was saying, particularly about Fergal, that he was brilliant at that and being able to adapt the training sessions to the way that Tyrone wanted to play. So it's just, I hadn't heard, so it made it even like, it was just very sad to hear he was only 47. I think he had two kids as well, so to be taken so young, it's just a real tragedy.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And it was interesting, the drills relevant to games. And you remember the All-Ireland final, and I was at it, and I'm always watching warm-ups and what to do and drills just before a game. And I remember Dublin doing a drill in the warm-up that day, and it was two groups, and it was a diagonal ball to the left, it was a 1-2, and they'd score a goal or a point after it. And like the Dublin goal in the first minute came from James McCarthy winning the throw-in, gave a lovely little diagonal ball into Niall Scully, who threw it back to him. Now, the drill I saw was to James McCarthy, take it on, you know, but obviously players aren't stupid, and you go, right, what's the drill or what's happening in front of me? And Dean Rocket then peeled off, threw it past to him, fastest goal ever in history. And it's like, it's adapting, right, we want to give diagonal balls, lads, you know, and instead of just getting players kicking diagonal balls, you're setting up a drill that potentially could be a match situation, you know. And I think good coaches can do that, and I've had good coaches who could do that. And then you have other drills which there's no real thought put into them, and like, which is fine as well, because some drills are good to warm you up, and that's all that they're designed for, which is fine. But then if you're doing some stuff that is, you know, has needs a practical example of things you want to happen on the field, that drill definitely has to be connected with that. And you have to then play a match afterwards. And if you see it happening and, it works well a couple of times, that the players get praise. Well done. You see how it's working. See how you bring that into a game. That's what good managers and trainers do. Because I've often got to train and you could do 10 drills in a night, and you just go from one station to the other, like almost like circuit training, and it's never explained why you're doing that. And it's like, what, you know, this is grand. At least there's a bit of variety to it. But what's it all about?
Yeah, and there's huge satisfaction to be gleaned from, like, I'll be honest, that hasn't really happened much in my career, but there's huge satisfaction to be gleaned from when you've worked on a move for a long time and when you execute it. You know, when you execute it to nearly perfection on the pitch, there's just a knowing look between players that, like, that's exactly as you said there, that's why we did that drill so often in training, as opposed to something, I know some drills that we're probably all used to, and whoever used the truck and trailer drill, for example, in a practical purpose on the pitch, whereas it might be good to kind of warm people up. But just on the Dublin drill in particular, I think Niall Scully might have mentioned that they kind of thought of it in the dressing room, but I thought I'd seen that from Dublin before. The only thing I'll have to say is, from a Mayo point of view, is I still, as really well executed as it was, and with Kerry the year before, I still don't think you should be conceding a goal from where it involves the midfielder running directly in a straight line towards goal at the throw-in. But listen, that was Mayo's fault and Kerry's the year before. Dublin had their drill practice and they executed it to perfection. So.
Yeah, no, they definitely did. Listen, I think this is the last one before we get into Anthony Nash. Paddy Bradley, this is in the Irish News today. They had a two-part interview with Paddy Bradley. And this is just a great little story. I really enjoyed it. And so I'll tell it to you now. So this is the last league final in Paddy Bradley's first year with the county. It was a league final match against Meath, and Bradley was only, he's only after turning 19, and he was on the bench. And Eamon Coleman was the Derry manager, obviously Eamon, who managed them to an All-Ireland in 93. And he used up all the substitutes and nearly every attacking substitute he had, and Paddy was still left on the bench. So Paddy goes home and he tells the story then. He says, I was telling my dad about it, and my dad said, ring the man. And I said, I'm not ringing Eamon Coleman. You know, he'd managed Derry to an All-Ireland. Tell him what? And my dad says, tell him how you feel. And I'll never forget it. So I rang him. And Eamon Coleman says, who is it? Paddy Bradley. What are you ringing about? Well, Eamon, I was just wondering, if you've something to say, come out and say it. So by the end of the phone call, I was saying, Eamon, you haven't a fucking clue. I'm the best forward you have, and you need to be playing me. Now, this is obviously coming from a man who has had these conversations with managers. So I was just kind of laughing that he started out asking him, you know, how am I not getting a game? And I just need one kind of confrontational thing. You haven't a fucking clue if you're not going to start playing me. So anyways, he says, you haven't a fucking clue. I'm the best forward you have, and you need to be playing me. Deep inside me, I believed it, but I never expressed it or showed it. So I turned up to training in Owen Beg on the Tuesday night, and I thought I'd better show it. Come Thursday night, Eamon names the team. This is for the championship against Cavan. Eamon names the team, and you could hear a pin drop whenever he named me corner forward. I couldn't believe it, and that was it. He picked me for Cavan, having not played me the week before against Meath, and him having played five forward subs before me. And he didn't talk to me before the Cavan game. I was nervous. Now, obviously, boys like Anthony Toll and Henry Downey would come up and talk to me. I scored 3 points in the first half against Cavan. It was my debut, but I'd come off with shin splints at halftime. I wanted it to go so well, and I was crying when I had to come off. I remember Eamon walking by me and leaning over and saying, I always knew it was in you, Bradley, and with a wee cheeky grin. He says, that was the class of Eamon Coleman. What a great little story.
Yeah, I was reading this earlier on, William. First of all, anytime I saw Paddy Bradley's name, I was inserting your name. And then for Eamon Coleman, various Laois managers that you've played over the years. And imagine in the conversations between the two of you. But I know it's told very well, you know, because it sounds like Eamon Coleman was very kind of, he was having none of Paddy Bradley's guff at the start, and was a proper kind of, they had it out properly. But I'd say Eamon Coleman always knew that he was going to eventually end up playing Paddy Bradley. And he probably thought after this conversation, you know what, this fella has a bit of a cut to him. He's a bit different about him. He's prepared to prepared to put his money where his mouth is, let's say. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think that in this day and age now, where it has become so much about the team, that if a player said that to a manager now, you haven't a fucking clue, you need to start playing me, do you think he could find himself out in his ear?
Depends on the player, Willie, I would say. Like, if the guy in Paddy Bradley's situation is a guy who's all attitude at training and who kind of is a disruptive figure, let's say, and stuff, and like, yeah, he's maybe not the most reliable, and then he comes out with that sort of stuff. Whereas if somebody who obviously, like Paddy Bradley, is ridiculously talented, has, you know, thinks he's been hard done by, if he obviously was, where there was five forward subs being played before him, I think you'd weigh it up about the character in question and kind of what his personality is like. Because we probably all met them over the years, Willie, but there's plenty of people who are more than happy to shoot their mouth off about the reasons they weren't playing, and then you give them their chance and they're not all that.
Yeah.
So it would be up to the individual manager to make that calculation about the specific player. I'd like to think that they could still do it in this day and age, even though it has become maybe more about the team. But there's always, if a player is good enough like that, there's always room for that little bit of kind of individualism as well.
Yeah, I love the way Eamon Coleman didn't even give him a pep talk before the game. I'd say in Eamon's head, he's like, let's see this whippersnapper now. Let's see what he's going to do. He talked a good game on Tuesday night. I'm going to let him out there now and see what he can do. I'm not going to say anything to him. And I suppose that's a good part of management as well. You know, let's give him the bit of rope. See, does he hang himself, or see, is he good enough? And obviously, as it turns out, Paddy was definitely good enough. I think that conversation personally reflects really, really well on Paddy, and really, really, really well on Eamon as well. Right, we'll leave it there, Conor, and we'll come back with Anthony Nash.
Wake up. Rise and shine, winter's gone and summer's fine. Wake up, wake up, wake up, rise and shine.
So last December, Anthony Nash retired from intercounty hurling after 16 years playing with the Cork seniors. Actually, he won a minor All-Ireland in 2001. So he's playing with Cork about 20 years, maybe in total. And he joins us on the line now. How's it going, Anthony?
Hi, Conor. How are you getting on? How are you keeping? Jeez, you're making me feel old there again now.
But that's some chunk of your adult life playing for Cork. Like, I mean, how are you coping without it?
When I sat down after it, you kind of look back that everyone, like, you put it correctly there, that you think that, oh, you played so many years for Cork at a senior level. But I suppose since I'm 16 years of age, I've been up and down the road to Cork. So I suppose it was the main focus of my life for a long time. You know what? I actually had a conversation with a couple of the lads there about it over the last couple of weeks, and they're asking me the same thing, how are we getting on? It's actually, in a weird way, I think it's a good time to get out of it, because just with the way things are going with COVID and with the restrictions and everything like that, it's just not the same at the moment, and it wasn't the same last year. Will I miss it? Of course I'll miss it. There's absolutely no doubt about that, especially when the weather starts to pick up and everything gets back open up again.
Yeah.
But for now, I'm okay. I'm okay, thank God.
Yeah, you're definitely not missing it now, because nobody's playing anyway. Come here, what was it with the announcement on the 6th of December, the week before the All-Ireland Final? I think I was saying on the show at the time you were trying to overshadow the All-Ireland Final.
Oh, God, no, I'm not that important. Not that important. No, look, I suppose I had a conversation with Kieran. He was just starting to get things going again, and we had a chat, and look, we kind of had a lengthy enough chat after the tip match and stuff, and just at the end of the conversation, we kind of decided that, look, that this year wasn't for me. And in fairness to him, look, he was very, very good about it, and I was the same with him. There was no ill feelings leaving. So just wanted to put it to bed, you know, more than
right.
Anything. I actually, strangely enough, when I did up, you know, someone actually said it to me as well, that, geez, you have to pick a good old week to do it. Like, and it wasn't even in my head. Like, I suppose, you know, that timing wasn't meant in any way or anything like that. It actually was good in a way, because it didn't linger too long when people were focusing on the other in the final rather than my retirement. So
I guess,
which is good too.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. So it kind of went under the radar a little bit more than it would have if it had been in January or right now. We'd be all over it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Come here, so like, it's fair to say you served your dues with Cork before you got your break in 2012.
Yeah. Do you know what? Like, at the time, frustrations and doubt, I suppose, were there whether I was ever going to be good enough to make it. I've often said this before, that, like, there was a couple of times where I came home and I was demoralised, and my family actually spoke me back into going back up, and my parents especially kind of would have said, come on, you're good enough, and drive on. And I never really believed this, because even in 16, when I was 16, back in 2001, when we did win the minor All-Ireland, my father had to get me a trial. My father rang a guy. He said, look, I think that I was good enough at the time. And we nearly had war inside the house, because I didn't think I was up to it at all. And fortunately, it worked out well in the long run. But so there was times, yeah. But, like, you know, I was behind two goalkeepers at the time that were definitely superior to me. So it was just biding my time. And I was enjoying training, and I was enjoying having the friendships up there as well. And I knew when I was coming back to play for Cantor that I was coming back in a better place anyway. But it was just that I was involved in a very good setup, and as I said, with players that I couldn't dream of becoming friends with, let alone, you know, like, I used to watch them on TV and idolise them, let alone going into the dressing room, sharing a car with them and stuff like that. So it was an eye-opener for a young fella from Cantor to get onto that panel. Like,
I suppose what kept you going maybe at that time is you were winning intermediate All-Irelands. You know, you were getting some kind of maybe on-field enjoyment.
Yeah, no, and you know what? It was a great competition at the time. Like, it was a very competitive game. I can't remember the year now, but we drew with Kilkenny, and, like, you had Richie Power and his brother, and, geez, you had, I think, John Tennyson was playing the same day, and we drew with them and went to a replay. Unfortunately enough, we won, but I think it was a report at the time that they were two of the best hurling games of the year, like, you know, obviously at a lower level at the time. But, geez, the competition was very, very, very competitive, like, so I was very lucky, yeah, and I used to go out there some years and I'd be third choice for Cork on the bench, and then I'd play the intermediate game, run back in, tog out and go back out and warm up with the seniors. Like, so I was actually involved in both games on the same day.
Right.
But, you know, great. And you know what? I wouldn't have gotten where I was only for that competition either. I wouldn't have gotten half the spotlight, because at the time we were junior with Kanturk, and I had gotten into college, right? Like, but apart from that, the intermediate gave a good eye opener for me.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, you went from 6 years, like we're saying, as understudy to Donal Óg to finally getting your chance. And that's pretty much because Donal Óg got injured at the I think in the league in 2012. Then you end up almost rags to riches. You go from being an understudy that not many people, well, I hadn't heard of you. I'm not a hurling person. I'm sure hurling people would have known about you. And then to an all-star in 2012. Player of the Year nominee in 2013. You know, your penalties become a national debate. The Nash rule kind of coming into effect in 2014. It really went from zero to boom.
Yeah, like, you wouldn't have been the only one that wouldn't have heard of me. it was accelerated, but the good thing, and in a strange way, like, because no, I didn't have a long career after because I started in goal from 27 years of age, but I actually was at a good age to get in. You can kind of be, if I was fired in at 22, 23,
yeah,
especially goalkeeper, you can kind of be maybe a little bit inexperienced and stuff. So I'd learned off Martin Coleman, Donal Óg Cusack for a long time and watched what they were good at and tried to imitate some of the things, you know, and while still bringing my own thing. But it was like, do you know what? No, there was like no one of the years under Dennis Walsh. There was reports going out in the newspaper that I was one of the lads left off the panel. Unfortunately enough, I don't know what happened, but at the end of it, I got a phone call to say this wasn't true. It had reached Evening Echo before it had reached the players, the two or three of us that were supposed to be dropped, and it wasn't. Right. So I don't know what came first, was the donkey or the cart or the cart or the donkey, but it worked out well in the long run. So there was times there I was training to train, you know, and I was going up and before I got in, I can guarantee you that 99% of the GAA community wouldn't have known who the hell I was or where the hell I came from.
But what was it like kind of around that time for you? Because it must have been, you know, crazy, the whole controversy around the penalties. I was kind of liking them to a volleyball serve where you throw the ball way up ahead of yourself and come running after it. Like, I mean, it's some skill. And I saw you kind of playing it down and saying that, you were robbing yards, but you weren't robbing that much more than other players. It's just you threw it up way higher for whatever reason. Maybe you might explain why you did that.
My legs were slower. I had to go higher.
Or was it the heavy? Was it the heavier hurl? Maybe to have to be able to get that kind of timing right.
Do you know what? Like, I spoke to my dad about it, and he was saying that he was the reason behind it. Like, there was a fella here, the Captain Cork as well, Kieran Murphy, the hero, is his nickname. He would have done a similar style. He was the first guy I ever kind of saw doing it. And you know, I don't know where it initially came from, but the reason I threw it higher was, I suppose, to try and steal those yards. But come here, I can guarantee you, like, on many a training pitch or league games or Cantork or something like that, they would have gone pear-shaped and I would have ended up in my arse, you know, trying to chase the ball. Like, but, I don't know. Look, it was actually just before we played Wexford in 2012, I was told, literally in Thurles, that I was taking the penalties. So it wasn't that we had kind of worked them over the years to get to this thing. So,
right.
The controversy, the only issue I ever had with it was the timing of the rule change. I had no issue with the rule change whatsoever because Tony Kelly and TJ Reid were starting to perfect it. So, ironically, I would have been the one to get one in the throat if we played them. So, I was glad they went back behind the 21. It was just that, like, so we were in, like, no, did we play Waterford in the league or was Waterford in the Championship?
Championship. Sure. Stephen O'Keefe, I think it was Championship.
Yeah, and next thing, all of a sudden, middle of Championship, the rule has changed. Now, we were lucky because we had Patrick Horgan, who could take penalties from outside of 21 and could score them. But I remember I got woeful abuse there, and geez, it was funny abuse kind of in a way, like on Twitter after the Ireland final that year, because I think Kilkenny and Tip played that year and Kilkenny hacked two of the Tipperary players down and they got two penalties and both were saved.
Yeah.
Because it was outside of 21 and three on the line, which meant it's very, like, disadvantageous for the penalty taker. So I got the blame bin, of course, for that. It was the only issue I ever had was the timing. It was just that we were, you know, I didn't mind per se for Cork because, as I said, we were haunted to have Hoggy. But I just feel that it would want to be something extremely dramatic to be changing in the middle of the Championship. Like, but look, it is what it is. It's done and dusted. And the later I got in the year, years in my life, I wouldn't have been able to make that ball and I would have had to throw it even higher. So I'm probably better off.
So you mentioned the penalty 2012 against Wexford. You did that technique and there was nothing about it. It was, I suppose, listen, it's very obvious. You do it in an All-Ireland final and Patrick Kelly, you know, came running out to meet it. Now you're like, there is a million watching on television and this is huge. And then you did it in the replay and you did it from a free and the clear put everyone on the line and you smashed it through the whole lot of them. I have to say, we were saying at the start of the show, the drama when you were coming up to take them was fantastic.
Yeah, do you know Brian Whelan? Actually, he followed me on Twitter there when I retired, and Brian is obviously a legend of the game, and he put up a nice tweet. I wasn't linked into one of my friends actually screenshot and sent it on to me, and he said that the drama when I was coming up, when you're in this, you don't feel it. It was the big thing for me. The 2013 goal, I know which one of them it was. What gave me the most enjoyment wasn't the fact that the penalty or whatever like that. I looked at my teammates and I saw them celebrating, and it was just me being able to bring, as a goalkeeper, unless you save a penalty, you don't get the adulation or you don't see the emotions of the other players because you're in the middle of a game making a save.
Yeah, but you just see their backs.
Absolutely. And the big thing for me was, after seeing the video, I see Pat Cronin, Luke O'Farrell, Hoggy, all key mechanics, lads jumping for joy, and being able to bring that to your teammates was something that was great, and it was cool to see.
That's an interesting one. Do you sometimes feel a little bit detached from the team for that reason?
You do as a goalkeeper. Up until 2017, Pat Ryan, I was very lucky, right? I worked under one of the greatest managers of all time, in Jimmy, and he made us all feel like a community, and it was absolutely fantastic, and he left us I felt so involved with the team. But then when you do get in as a goalkeeper, it is a position where you are completely different. Hoggy makes jokes with me all the time. As soon as you come outside the small square, it's like being a fish out of water. Your skill levels go way down to where you actually wouldn't think. But so at the time, it was great, and stuff like that. But then the next time that I felt that again was 17, when Pat Ryan came in as a coach. And he just proposed that we change our puck outs. And I kind of got back more involved in the team again, because in 16, as a goalkeeper, it's either you hit the ball very long and hopefully make a save. But when the penalties were gone, the next time I was kind of more involved in the games again was 17. It's a fair point as a goalkeeper that you might feel that you're a little bit distant. But I think nowadays, it's gone to the stage where you have to be able to put a puck into a fellow's hand from distance. So they're kind of getting more involved again.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned 2017, because I was in Thurles for that Tipperary game, and Tipperary were strong favourites for that game, but you were outstanding. And I remember talking to The Rock before that game, we were previewing it, and Galway had beaten Tip in the league final, and they had done a good thing with Cathal Mannion dragging Paddy Maher across the half forward line and stuff. And I remember asking The Rock about this, and he just started laughing and went, he brushed it off. And the reason I know he brushed it off is because that's exactly what you did that day. I remember seeing it, and your puck outs were a huge thing for Lehan and Harnedy, and it was a different type of puck out, was it, Anthony, in that it was all based on leaving space and these lads breaking into it. So you weren't hitting players anymore. You were hitting kind of squares of space.
Yeah. So as I said, Pat was a great help that year. So he came in and basically just allowed the goalkeepers to have the freedom to go for, harder puck outs in a more dangerous area, because we were at a time where, if you looked at the percentage of our long puck outs, we just weren't winning them. So he asked us to kind of bring it back a small bit, to more to the half ordering. When I first started playing minor under 21, you went back into the goals, got your puck out hurley and drove it as far as you could.
Yeah.
But teams are after catching on to that. And what happens is you actually compact your forward line. So therefore, you're actually shooting yourself in the foot by having 6 and 6 inside the 45, rather than, every team is at it nowadays trying to create space for the full forward line. So we started doing that in 17 from puck outs, where we kind of tried to initiate. And it's actually not that you were hitting pockets of space. It was, for us, it was just, if the movement was there, we had to just, the goalkeepers had to improve their skill, where if, let's say you said Conor Lehan made a run 10 yards, by the time he was on his stride, you actually had to have it 2 yards ahead of him so he could catch it while turning.
Right, so you're hitting the moving target then, which is even harder.
So in fairness to Pat, as I said, he allows us, I remember we were in the second pitch in Carrigaline training in November, and when he first introduced it to me, and I was standing there going, geez, Pat, you're mad. I can't do this. And he got us practicing, gave us the thing. And just fortunately enough, that year, it kind of helped a bit. All right. And it gave me huge confidence,
It definitely did, because you have so many puckouts in a game, and it was almost guaranteeing you possession, and other teams weren't really ready for it. And that was reflected in, obviously, your two Munster titles, in that time. So, when did you find them starting to get figured out? I know Limerick wouldn't even bother following the players. They'll just keep their halfback line in their positions, and that kind of scuppers that plan.
So that's exactly what happens. You either have a zonal defence or you have a man-to-man defence. And that's basically where Hurling is at the moment. Like, when you look at the half-back lines, the opposition, do they hold, do they go side? Do you know, like, you'd have to obviously try and change it. So when we started doing this, I'm sure knowing someone's going to listen to this and go, hold on a second, we were at that since 14, 13, 15, whatever. But I suppose it was just, we had gone from such a poor year in 16 to such a high in 17 that teams probably went, oh, geez, look what they're doing. They're after revolutionising. So we didn't revolutionise anything. We just basically tried to improve on our weaknesses, and our aerial ability at the time was considered to be a weakness. So we just had to maybe lower the height of the puckouts and get moving targets and use our pace as our attribute. So when did it start catching on? I suppose every team, Derek McGrath actually came into the dressing room after we played them in 17, I think, after the first game, and he said they had focused so much on our puckouts that they forgot about themselves. And in the other semi-final, in it, and flipped around and they held a different thing and they ended up beating us. Now, we were unfortunate with being down to 40 minutes of time. But I suppose teams did start to set up more, they were definitely more switched on from 17 on, that they felt that we had changed other things. But like, as I said to you, look, we're not the only team that do that, far from it. Other teams are starting to imitation is not what I'm saying. They're trying to improve on it and do their own thing. And you can see a lot of goalkeepers now are asked to hit moving targets, hit shorter targets, whereby, again, like I said, when I first started playing Jay, it was back into the goal, puck out early, and as high and as long as you could give it, that's the way you pucked it out.
But I remember your puckouts gaining such a reputation. Like, I mean, I was at that Waterford game in the All-Ireland semi-final that year, and you put one out over the sideline and a huge cheer went up in Croke Park, like Waterford were after getting a point. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I don't really look back at games, but I look back at that and Derek McGrath, I'd say, nearly hit the roof of the whatever side. So happy, but yeah, I suppose, like, you kind of, look, I don't know, do you take it as a compliment or do you take it as a...
You should take it as a compliment, yeah.
But yeah, and like, again, like my penalties, like we addressed earlier, like there was many a puck that went wrong. But the big thing for me, and going back to Pat, was Pat told the players in 17 that he was asking me to change something and I was going to make loads of mistakes. So we needed to back him up. And the big thing for me that year, and the players don't get enough credit, was they turned over balls that I miss hit or I miss pucked or whatever like that and won them back, and nothing came of the score. So nothing came of me hitting a bad puck out, and everyone was more focused on the positives. So that was the big thing. I actually do remember it. I do remember it, yeah. I don't know. I suppose we had to do it. Otherwise, we weren't going to be able to do anything, you know. And again, the biggest thing from everyone says it, it's actually the movement of the forward line. That's actually the key, and the willingness of the forwards. We have a job. We're supposed to put a ball to a certain place. And if we can't do it, then you're not in the team. You know what I mean? So it was really not me, really.
Would that cheer, though, you know, when you hear that cheer, would that make your next one, you go, geez, I better go for an easier one this time, you know?
No. Go again.
Okay.
I was encouraged to go again. Like, you know, it was the one thing that Don Logue kind of taught me when I was playing. He used to go for, like, Don Logue used to do similar puckouts back in the day, like, you know, when I first joined the train. Charting him and stuff, and I remember a couple of games there where he'd go for one, he put over the sideline, he'd go for it again, exactly in pocket. And I kind of said to him one day, he said, look, they expect to go along the next time, so go again. And you know, if you're doing the right thing, and that's the big thing about, you know, like I when I coach teams, like if you're trying to do the right thing and you make a mistake, well, fine, okay, I've asked you to do the right thing. And they, Cork were asking me to do that, and if I did it wrong, and obviously it's my fault, my skill level wasn't high enough, but if I'm trying to do the right thing, I was told that I could drive on and do it. So it was just the confidence of having that behind me allowed me to go again and again and again. Otherwise, you hit one bad one in a game, the rest were done by the 45. And sure, that's not what you're asked to do.
Yeah, it undermines the whole thing, obviously, yeah.
Come here, like, you look at football, like, every goalkeeper in football that can do it now, like, he's told to, you know, the game has changed, like, you know, completely. So if one of those goalkeepers make a bad kick out, and next thing all of a sudden he kicks it long, so the other team are swarming around the break, the big midfielder was up, breaks it down, and all of a sudden they're on the counter-attack, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, I like Don Logue. Don Logue would be tick enough to go, here, well, listen, there's no way I'm, you know, backing down off this. I'm going to go for the exact same one. I can imagine exactly how he would, his mind would work that way.
That's why he was so good. Like, yeah. That's why he was so, he had no fear of stepping back and going, right, I hit a bad puck out there. No, he didn't hit too many bad ones, to be fair to him.
No.
But if he hit one, overrun or hit one, he didn't stand back and say, right, that's me done for the game. I'm going back into my shell and long. You know, so, and
I mean, ticking off in a good way there, obviously.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And that's a huge compliment. He was very, you know, he was very, not stubborn, but he was very, you know, strong in his own mind about his own ability. Like, he was whatever he, like, looked at, you could go back over the videos and see how good he was, like, you know.
Yeah, no, he definitely was. One other controversy I want to ask you about is the 2017 Munster final, where the Clare backroom team robbed your slitters. When did you notice that your slitters were robbed, or did you know your slitters were robbed, and why would they have robbed your slitters?
Like, so this fierce talk around Cork, about Cork having magical slitters that we, I don't know what in the name of sweet Jesus people were. So basically, the slitters I would have taken into goal were the official All-Star slitters, that are official O'Neill slitters, or whatever ball we're using, but they were just worn in 2 or 3 days beforehand in training, where the rims were not standing up too high. That's all they were. Nothing magical.
And were you paring down? Were you paring down the rims, or was that an old trick of Don Logue's?
Come here. Even when I played with Don Logue, I don't remember him doing that, but maybe he did. They're just basically on maybe a Tuesday night or a Thursday night before we play championship.
It was
they were just worn in at training, and it was just, they're a nicer ball to strike. So, of course, Don Logue was in the backroom team at the time. I'm not putting two and two together. We had a joke about it since, like, because I actually met him for a coffee once. So I came in after the warm-up, and next thing, Pat Keane and Breen Hurley. So Breen Hurley is my goalkeeping coach, and Pat Keane is the logistics officer. But two great characters and two very close friends of mine. So Pat goes to me, "Your ball's a gun?" Or Richie Mooney said, "Your ball's a gun, your ball's a gun." And I was like, "Yeah, Richie was our Masur time." And I said, "What do you mean the ball's a gun?" And he goes, "The ball's a gun, the ball's a gun." And next thing, I said, "Where are they gone, like?" He said, "Some Clare flick came along and fired them into the crowd." So what they hadn't realised is Pat Keane is so good at his job that not only had I don't know, a dozen or two dozen, Pat had 100 warning balls inside in the bag. So he came along, handed me the new things, the slitters, and off we went as if nothing happened. So it rocked me for about 10 seconds, but all I do to Richie was say, "Run over there now, get Pat, tell him bring the bag over." And the umpires were, I don't know what referee was refereeing the game, but I loved that the two lads were sound out, and they were like, "Jesus, look, we didn't see him walk away." But he actually messaged me, that guy messaged me after and apologising and everything, because, "Come here, look, if you know," again, maybe like the puck out, if that's what they're worried about, they were overthinking about our puck outs and changing the slitters and stuff. But fortunately that day, it didn't affect us too much. I think they actually changed their slitters that day as well. They normally used All-Star, and they had a different slitter that day, so I know they'd gone that far in the length to try and change it. But
right, so they'd hope to throw your All-Star ones out that you liked, and then there would be no other choice but to use all the balls that they brought on the day,
or else ones that we hadn't ready or worn in and stuff like that,
or ones they worn in. Yeah,
come here, like, you're going to make me out to be a nutter here, like, in this program, and people worn slitters and fecking.
No, I'm very interested in all this stuff. I never played hurling. This is very interesting stuff to me. Like, I mean,
an O'Neill football is an O'Neill football, right? That's it.
Yeah.
If it's like me saying to you, right, you're about to take a free, give me that O'Neill football, and here have a different style of football completely. You're kind of going, well, it's a bit lighter or it's a bit heavier. And slitters are the same. The slitters have changed, like, you know. Most teams know you come and all stars from Cork, right? Like, and especially with the yellow slitter being brought in. But
should we know from tennis, to use a tennis example, when new balls come in, the fast servers love it, right?
Yeah.
Same thing.
The new ones are harder. Basically, they can come out of the packet brand new. They can be absolutely lovely. The rims can be small, or they can be big, and the things like that. And it just basically changes. Like, and any hurler will tell you, free taker will tell you, like, if the rims are big in a slitter, like, you're just not getting the same contact in the ball. Again, no, people might think that. Like, I can guarantee the older generation listening to me here now going, "No wonder they've won nothing, and no wonder Nash is gone, and no wonder that." Like, it does 100%. Ask any decent free taker or any good free taker at any level, all the way up. If the rims are big in a ball, number one, you're going to break your hands with catching it, and number two, the slitter is not going to travel the same way. Like, so. Right.
Would just one or two training sessions the week of a game tear them down enough? One.
10 or 15 pucks would wear in the ball, not a bother. So, like, and it would have just changed. The ball would have been a lot nicer and easier to take strikes with or control and stuff like that. And, like, every team, come here, I don't know any team that wouldn't have liked the fact. And that's all they were. Nothing magical, nothing at all. They were just warning slitters. And we just got lucky that Pat Keane was so good at his job.
It didn't make any difference. That's a good one. Come here, before I let you go, you've transferred from Kanturk. I'm sure that was a huge, you know, psychological thing for you to do. You're gone to your cousin. I didn't realise you were Barry Nash's cousin from Limerick. You've transferred to South Liberties.
Yeah, so in fairness to Cantor, they were absolutely fantastic, and I rang the chairman, Kieran Fitzgerald, straight away when I, look, I hadn't, so when I finished, I was finished, and I always said to Cantor that when I was finished with Cork, I was finished with Cantor as well, because it was just always in my head, don't ask me why, so I rang Cantor, and I said, look, that's, my uncle actually rang me, my uncle Noel Nash, and he said, I always promised him a year, you know. Don't there, and like, so
that was when you were drinking up in Limerick a couple of times, and you have to back it up now.
No, in fairness, like I always said, I would, like, so when I was growing up, I, both my family is from Limerick, so my mother has a nephew, Albert Shanahan, who would have played in goals for Limerick as well around the times of Joe Quaid. So he's on my mother's side, and he would have played. My grandfather Paddy Shanahan is actually still, I think, the honorary president of the club, but he was chairperson of the club as well. So that side of the family would have been involved in it. On the other side, my father had five brothers that would have been on the team as well. So I would have actually gone to matches where I had one cousin and I had, I think, five uncles playing on the same team.
Right.
So I would have been watching them play more than I would have watched Cantor, because we used to go and spend weekends down there. And just always in my heart, I always wanted to play with them. So Cantor, as I said, were absolutely fantastic and said that they knew the transfer form would eventually come, and it's a lovely way to finish out my career. And now I'm fortunate enough that my uncle Mick, who would have played for Liberties, is a selector, and Barry, his son, and Brian, also his other son Brian, would both be playing on the team as well. So I finally get a chance to play with my family, which is nice. Now come here, I'm sitting here in March saying that I'm going to be able to play. I'm a 36-year-old croc. My back could give way, and all of this could come to nothing. But I'm actually doing a small bit of coaching with them as well, so it's nice to do that as well. Well, I will be doing coaching with them, as an unfortunate statement, when everything opens up. But yeah, no, look, it's a nice way to finish out my career, and all my friends in Cantork were very open to the idea. I know they were disappointed, obviously, but they were very open and very, very, very nice to me about it, really. And always said that the welcome is always there in Cantork, because look, I played all my hurling with them, but it's just something that I always wanted to do. And I'm looking forward to getting going, number one, and hopefully it'll go well.
Yeah, fingers crossed. That's a lovely little story. It's a great way to finish your career. I completely agree.
And that's the point. Like, you can, there's nothing else to it. Like, you know, like, you'd hear rumours and you hear all this rubbish. Like, but look, yeah, no, the big thing for me is that, like, I, you know, we won in All-Ireland with Cantork in 2017, I think, in Tweed All-Ireland. And I looked around at all my friends, and they were all hugging their cousins, their brothers, their whatever, their uncles that were supporting and stuff like that. And my family were there, absolutely. But we're the only family out of my family that would have played for Cantork. So while I had my best friends on the field, and it was one of the best feelings of my hurling career, I just would love to put on the same jersey as my family does. And as I said, I'll be like a little 10-year-old running onto the field the first time I do get to wear the jersey.
I think the rumours you're probably talking about is that it's JP McManus's club and you're going to be a millionaire for transferring up. Is that what you're talking about?
If that was the truth, how would I be? You know, look, the rumours are rumours. You know yourself from playing over the years.
Yeah.
Rumours will follow people everywhere, but yeah, no, it was just absolute and club manic. But you know what? It's silly season, like, you know, with everything going on at the moment and no GA going on, everyone just wants to talk about something. But like, you know, 99% of the comments that I've received were very positive. And like you just said there a while ago, when people actually do hear the story, which they didn't know, they go, oh, look, that is, and it is to finish my career. That's it. I want to be able to finish it. I want to be able to finish it that way. And I gave everything I could to Cantork. And now hopefully I'll give everything to Stoke Liberties for however long is left in my body. And
yeah.
The plan, and look, I do think after giving, as you mentioned a while ago, I'm after giving, what is it, 20 more than 20 years nearly to Cork at this stage, that that people will just understand why I'm doing it. So
yeah,
but look, I think
you've explained it fairly well there, Anthony. Anyways, anyone listening will know the connection, you know, that's there, and not to be minding all the rumors. Anthony, come here, listen, I've taken up enough of your time. Thanks very much, and congratulations on a brilliant career.
Thanks very much, appreciate that.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going. So it opened up.
We were only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken. I let it go, 'cause I won't see you later.